Are you confused about real food and what's healthy and good for the planet? Do you need the facts about local, organic, and sustainable food? Well, get ready to change the way you eat. Get ready for The Appropriate Omnivore with Aaron Zober.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of The Appropriate Omnivore. I'm your host, Aaron Zober, covering lifestyles in the world of real food. On October 17th, the Weston A. Price Foundation will be holding its annual Wise Traditions Conference, this year in Salt Lake City, Utah. As has been the tradition on The Appropriate Omnivore, I'll be interviewing several of the upcoming speakers. My speaker for this week is Mike Keene. Mike Keene has worked professionally as a chef where he's traveled around the world learning about food and diet. His Wise Traditions presentation is entitled Eating Greenland, an Evolutionary Diet Revelation. Mike, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much for having me on, Aaron.
Yeah, and I'm glad you can make time. I know you're all the way over in England. So with that, I always want to have guests because these are recorded ahead of time. And it's always a thing of working on our schedule, as I know you're 8 hours ahead of me as I'm on the Pacific coast.
Yeah, it's a big time difference there.
I'm sure also you have a lot going with your travels and all this. So I'm very happy that you can fit this in.
Oh, no, thank you.
Yes. So let's start. Tell us about your background as a chef.
Okay, I'm 56 now, and I've been a chef pretty much since I was 16. So I've started off in England, and then I traveled. I lived abroad a lot as a kid in Saudi Arabia and Nigeria, and that gave me the travel bug, I think. So as soon as I got into hospitality, I took off cruise ships based in the Caribbean, out of Miami and Puerto Rico, and also from Hong Kong and Shanghai and the South China Sea for a while. And then worked, I was in New Zealand for a bit, up in Buffalo, New York for a year, Canada for a little while. Yeah, so I've been around and seen quite a few different cultures and styles of food and fermentation, obviously, as well, and just kept rolling on. It's never really stopped. I came back to the UK when I got married and we had four kids, all grown up now. But as soon as they were grown up, I was off out again. And that took me to North Atlantic, Iceland, Faroes and Greenland. And I was on the search for extreme fermented foods. At the time, I'm trying to write a book. I'd been given a contract and then they paid for me to go to Norway and then just basically track the Vikings as they left Norway, populated Faroes, then Iceland, and then Greenland, which was fascinating. And then as soon as COVID hit, I was stuck in Greenland for a bit and they dropped me as an author. So that was a bummer. But by then they'd already paid for my ticket. So they weren't getting that money back. So I was in Greenland and that's where my whole culinary journey totally changed and effectively started. It was a real wake-up call for looking at how we've eaten evolutionary wise and the food that we're designed to eat and meant to eat. And from there I just took a deep dive into anthropology, because it wasn't just the Vikings, obviously, who got there about 1,000 years ago. The Inuit had been there coming the other way from Alaska and Siberia 5 or 6, maybe 7,000 years ago. So they've been there and totally adapted to their environment. The reason why it was Greenland was because it's so visceral and you look out and there's clearly no agriculture. There's no trees. It's just rock, ice and water. And that's it. And you think, how the hell did anyone survive here? And not only survive, but they thrived. They ended up all around the coast of Greenland. And before Western culture via the Danes got involved 300 years ago, super fit, really hardy, incredible people. Yeah, the nicest people you ever meet. That's where it all happened for me, was Greenland and the different types of ferments and the old ways of preservation. And it just clicked in my brain that, of course, this is what we've been doing for millions of years. What are we doing to ourselves now? It's ridiculous what we've done to ourselves pretty much since the Second World War. But going back, you can see it change with the advent of capitalism and the nurturing of agriculture 10,000 years ago. It's on a downward trajectory from there. So that's it. That's how I got into it. And that now I've got the bug and I'm spending a lot of time researching these diets and trying them out on myself.
Yes, that's interesting when you talk about Greenland, about how there's not much there, because it's a misconception actually that Greenland is the one that's filled with ice and Iceland is actually the one that's green.
It's fairly green. Yeah. Iceland still gets its fair share of ice.
Yes. And I know that part of your talk at the Wise Traditions is about your time in Greenland, as is in the title of the presentation, and your solo kayak expedition, eating only in ancestral Inuit diet. So tell us a little about that.
That was about 7 years ago. I first went to Greenland, and since then I've been there about 11 or 12 times. But on that third time, I was cooking at a really remote camp outside Nuuk, the capital. And I had a couple of beers with a fellow chef, and we were just talking about the language, because the language is totally different to any European Latin, Greek languages. They've got a lot of Q's in the language. And the town in the furthest south is called Kakotok, with three Q's in, and the town right in the far north is Karnak. And then the Greenland Inuit obviously invented the kayak, which the correct spelling is Q-A-J-A-Q. So I thought, oh, wouldn't it be cool if you could kayak from Kakotok to Karnak? So it's all these Qs. Something just triggered in my brain. I thought, oh, okay, perhaps I should look at that. So I Googled it. It's just over 3,000 kilometres. I'd only been kayaking for almost 2 years at that point. And I thought, yeah, 3,000 kilometres. If I did 30K a day, that's 100 days, which that's probably doable. I can probably get some sponsorship for that. And then I thought, okay, it's going to be kayaking between 5 and 10 hours a day. Perhaps I should try and do something else, like the Inuit, for instance. They survived for thousands of years on kayaks made out of driftwood and sealskin. And yeah, none of the Gore-Tex or sat-nav or emergency beacons that we've got now. I thought, yeah, let's try that. And then I thought, oh, great. Wouldn't it be great to hook up with some microbiologists and scientists and test my microbiome and see what effects and transformation, if any, it was having on my body? And that was it. After that day, I talked myself into it. I think there's a tipping point where if you tell enough people, then you've got to do it. Otherwise, you look like an idiot. Mm-hmm. So that was it. And a year later, in April 23, I found myself in Kakotok in my kayak, ready to go, with 200 people clapping and cheering me on from the harbour there. It was incredible. So I'll just carry on. But the food I was eating was pretty much a keto diet. It was predominantly sea mammals, fish, a couple of land animals such as caribou and muskox occasionally. And you could have had seaweed, mushrooms, crowberries as well that were growing in Greenland, but I didn't have any of those. So the whole expedition took 4 months and I didn't touch a single piece of fruit or vegetable the whole time. So I took off at the end of April, and by the time I got to Nuuk, the capital, 3 or 4 weeks later, I'd lost 2 stone, 14 kilo, which I'm not overweight. Well, I didn't think I was overweight at the time, but to me, that was the first time I stepped on the scales and I thought, oh my word, this could be really bad, because I'm clearly using up all my fat reserves. At some point when I'm 10 kilometers out to sea, am I going to pass out and drown in the Arctic? But I thought, I'll sod it, I'll carry on and see what happens, because I felt fine. And yeah, I'd gone down to 75 kilo and I stayed at the same for the remaining 3 months. It just leveled out, which to me was amazing. I'd never felt that fit. And the actual diet, I wasn't eating that much since, did a lot of research into keto diets and stuff. And the satiety, how full you feel, is reasonably quick on a keto diet, on a carnivore diet. So yeah, I was having, to me, quite a small amount of food during the day and very much spread out. I'd never felt that good. I'd never had so much energy. I was sleeping well, even though it's 24-hour sunlight. So there's no dark periods.
Wow.
You're in a tent and it's bright light. But you sleep for 2 hours and then you're up for an hour or so and then you sleep for another 2 hours. And it's something that I was aware of, obviously, before I went out. But it's until you're actually immersed in it, you just don't appreciate the impact it has. So to me, having stretches of 2 hour bunches of sleep times three each kind of night was enough. And then I just got up and put on my dry suit, put on my gear in the kayak and set off again. It was an amazing time. And because I was so intrigued with the weight loss as well, I thought, that's got to be down, yeah, because I'm kayaking so much. I had the opportunity to go back to Greenland and do the same diet again, but this time without the kayaking. So exactly the same diet, but no physical exercise to speak of, really. I lost exactly the same amount of weight in slightly longer time, 4 weeks, but I came down to exactly the same weight, 75 kilo. It was extraordinary. And to me, that is me as we were as evolutionary humans before agriculture, and we started putting this hierarchy that we've got nowadays. My body, totally immersed in the environment, 100% as we used to. So I was eating food that was within 10K of where I was. I was in the sunlight or actually immersed in the weather the whole time, getting battered by the elements. My sleep was regulated by the sun and the lack of any dark. And everything was fantastic. My blood tests improved. Everything about it was great. So to me, that reinforced my eat your environment message of, we've only ever eaten for millions of years of evolution, what's in our environment and what is seasonal. So of course it makes sense that we've got to go back to that and do that now. You compare that kind of diet to what we're eating now and it's 100% different. It just so happened to be Greenland, but I could have been in any area where I was able to access and be connected to that indigenous and evolutionary background that we've always had for millions of years. If I was to do it in England, it would be a lot harder just because there's 65 million people here. So it's quite hard. And all the food you buy from supermarkets, none of it's seasonal anymore. You can get strawberries year round. You can get asparagus year round. Apples. England's got thousands of varieties of apples. And you go to a supermarket and there'll be 10 varieties. And 8 of them will be from South Africa or New Zealand or the other side of the globe. It's just crazy that we're doing this to ourselves. And it just makes sense to me that the apples that are grown in our immediate environment are the ones that we should be eating, as opposed to the ones that are grown out of season, spend 6 months on a boat, covered in antibiotics and fertilizers and spray to keep them ripe. The more I look into it, it just makes sense. Every time I find something new, it just reinforces that message that, yeah, we've got to go back to how we ate over millions of years of evolution, because we adapt and evolve so slowly to environmental and climatic conditions that it's impossible for us to adapt effectively to what we're doing to ourselves now, because it's moving and changing so fast. Within two generations, we've had the biggest change in our entire diet. Over our entire history, whether you go back 4 billion years to when the first single cells came out, or 2 million years when the first recognizable humans started appearing. So it's something I get very passionate about, and it's so interesting.
Well, I can see, yeah, you have a lot to be passionate about. And one of the things I think that I find the most fascinating is how you talk about being able to sleep well in the Northern Hemisphere where it doesn't get that dark out, and that makes sense. There's a reason that people have been able to sleep well in that environment for thousands of years because of eating the evolutionary diet.
Yeah, we've always had to adapt to, whether we're in England or Los Angeles or the Arctic or Antarctica. It's something we've obviously had to adapt to, and we have done really effectively. And I think that's something that we overlook a lot, because every time we look around and we see heart disease and diabetes and autoimmune diseases, but the body is such a finely tuned, amazing instrument that is totally 100% linked into the natural world. And how much of the natural world are we exposed to nowadays? It's minimal. And that difference really highlights why we've got all these man-induced diseases nowadays.
Yes. And you mentioned at the beginning about a number of different places that you lived. What are some other things you've learned in terms of health and diet and lifestyle in the other places?
Most of it is eat what's in your immediate area. The best things are always the stuff that's growing within 10 kilometers 20, 50 kilometers of where you are. The most genuine experiences in the food that I've had has not been in the restaurants. It's been at people's houses, which is, when you're traveling solo, it's much easier to make friends with locals and be absorbed and welcomed by the local community. If there's two of you or more, you tend to stay quite insular and stay within your comfort zone. But pushing yourself out and talking to people or trying to communicate with sign language if you don't speak the language is an incredible thing. And it's that connection, again, that I think we're losing a lot nowadays because of our modern lifestyles. It just seems to be getting in the way of everything. On the surface, it's fantastic. But if you start to scrape it away, and actually, to me, it seems quite superficial. And it's the big things that we miss nowadays, which is our evolutionary connection to the landscape and the food and the seasons. So, yeah, it's something that really needs to be pushed. And it's not just England and the West. It's pretty much everywhere I've been. You have that element of modern culture, of supermarkets and eat fast processed food, which is a terrible thing. So you have to go out of your way to search out and seek those local foods, which is really important.
You're right that it's everywhere, because as I attend these Wise Traditions conferences, and we've had people from places like France and Switzerland, which I've always viewed as some of the healthiest countries, and even they've said that the denaturing of foods, the industrialization is present in those places.
Yeah, it is. You go to Greenland, for instance, and the biggest town is the capital city, Nuuk, but it's only 17,000 or 18,000 people in, so it's the size of a big village here in the UK. But you go further out to the settlements, which have got 100, 200 people in maybe, and every single settlement has got a kind of subsidized convenience store, effectively a supermarket, and most of that, pretty much 99%, won't be Greenlandic food. It will be shipped in from thousands of miles away. But where Greenland beats the rest of the world in my eyes is that it has an incredible connection to its traditions and its landscape. Still, you go to the settlement and you go to Nuuk as well, and that you'll still get loads of hunters and fishermen going out to hunt sea mammals or fish, and they'll bring it back. But you can fly in, go to the supermarket, eat your pizzas or ready meals or instant noodles, and fly away again and not experience anything of the amazing bounty that the country's got to offer. Mm-hmm. But again, just making that effort and connecting with people, yeah, you'll get invited to a kafamik, which is like an open house where they serve loads of food, and you'll get the most incredible array and variety of dishes that were grown and caught and prepared from the waters just outside Newark or just outside the settlement. It's an incredible thing, incredible country to go to.
And in the different places that you've lived, were there any surprises in terms of stuff that you thought was healthy that wasn't, or vice versa?
Again, with the benefit of hindsight, yes. You look back, now that my eyes have been open to the whole evolutionary process and our connection with the landscape. At the time, when I was in Japan and eating sushi and instant noodles and stuff, you think, oh, that's pretty cool. But yeah, now, of course not, because the rice is super processed and polished. It's not something I eat nowadays with carbohydrates. So yeah, there is a hell of a lot when you think you're eating or you're shopping and buying food and preparing it, and it's something that's authentic and local. A lot of the time you could get the same food anywhere in the world. It can be quite depressing, and I get quite angry at myself, quite annoyed that it took me 30 years of being a chef to really appreciate what we should be eating. When I was a kid, I ate a candy bar and drank a Coke every day in the summer holidays, and you think, oh, this tastes great, it's brilliant. And my parents didn't know any better, and that generation, they were just told, yeah, I don't know, the Mars bar, a logo over here or slogan was, a Mars a day helps you live, work and play. It's like, what? Whoa. No, it doesn't help you at all. It's killing you. But you're just indoctrinated and brainwashed with all these messages. And you think, oh, okay, Mars bar, it's great. It's going to be a bit of energy. What could go wrong there? And now I look back and think, decades of eating crap. And I go, oh, man, I wish I'd been aware of what I know now. You never know what's going to happen in the future. At the moment, I'm super healthy, which is great. But yeah, maybe I caught it in time with the diet that I'm eating. But I'm sure if I'd been drinking and eating candy and sodas and carried on that way, I would have been a mess by now.
Yeah, same with me. I certainly didn't discover this till much later and wish I knew all about this early on. Things would be a lot different for me.
Yeah, it's that message that was so important to put across now to everyone, but especially the younger generation, because it's harder for them now, because I don't know about in the States, but in England, we're losing those skills. We're not really teaching the skills or even the knowledge of how food and farming and the environment work in our schools. It's up to the individuals and the parents and guardians of the children to teach them the food skills. And what you see a lot now is kids just don't have any skills in cooking. So what's going to happen when they progress through school, they finish and they're out there in the wide world, if they haven't got any food skills or knowledge of what they should be eating, they're just going to go with what's advertised on TV, or they're just going to go for the easy ready meal or ready pizza option. And that's a slippery slope into diabetes and heart disease, etc., what we spoke about before. So yeah, that's a big part of what I'm doing, is trying to get out to schools and just tell people about, without trying to bang the drum and be too much of a in your face guy about it. And I guess it's a lot easier when you've got a slideshow that's got polar bears and Arctic and icebergs and, right, and cool kayaking and stuff like that. If you can link that food message onto the cool visuals, it's a hell of a lot easier.
And going back to your journey in Greenland, I know first you did the kayaking and the diet along with that, and then went back to just eating the diet on that without the kayaking. What you learned about the traditional Inuit diet, how much of it did you stick to over time?
Every time we go back to Greenland, the traditional food, it's amazing. A lot of the ferments are incredible because they haven't got any trees out there. They haven't really got a culture of making salt, and so they haven't got a salted meat or salted fish tradition at all. And what it is, they just ferment it without the salt, which to me was mind-blowing. And the holy grail of ferments to me is called kiviak, which you only find up in the far north of Greenland. They catch 400 to 500 little orc seabirds, stuff them inside a seal, sew the seal up, and then push the air out, bury it underground or put it in a box 6 months, and then they'll open up the seal and you've got these wet rag dishcloth type things of birds, all the feathers and everything on. And then the first time you eat it, or any kind of fermented meat, it's like a super strong blue cheese. You know, that cheese you've got tucked down the back of the fridge since last Christmas, and you give it a go and it takes the skin off the roof of your mouth off. If you close your eyes and have the fermented meat, the bird or the seal, it's just like cheese. But if you're obviously looking at it and it's got healthy amounts of fat on, and it's got this real tanginess to it, and you think, how is this even possible? It goes against everything I've been taught as a chef. Here and in the US, everything's temperature checked. It's got to be in the fridge. If it's past its sell-by, throw it away. And here you've got a bird that's been inside a seal for 6 months. No salt, no preservation at all. It hasn't been frozen. The ambient temperature is about 8°C, and it's fermented. It's effectively rotted. And you eat it, and at first it can be quite challenging. It's not disgusting by any stretch. But by the end, yeah, I've eaten many times now. And last time I went back, I had three birds. You scoop the meat, it's as soft as pate, and you scoop it out, suck the brains out the back of the skull, eat the intestines, and it's incredible. I've never got sick or diarrhea from any of these extreme ferments, which to me was incredible because it goes against absolutely everything. Here we're taught eat five a day, you've got to get a good variety inside you. And actually, it's not quite true because that's not how we've evolved or what we've dealt with over millions of years. There have been occasions where we've only had one type of thing to eat for many weeks. There have been times when we have to go on a forced fast because there's no game or the weather's too bad or it's just dried up in that particular place. So we've evolved to so many different situations that we're super adaptable. Pretty much any kind of food you can get into. I talk a lot with Professor John Speth, who's at University of Michigan, and he's done a lot of research into fermented stroke rotten meats in tropical regions as well. It turns out that disgust is totally a learned reflex. It's not hardwired at all. The kids where I was in northern Greenland were tucking into this kiviak, this super strong meat, like it was chicken nuggets or a pizza. Yeah, they loved it. They really loved it. And it's just because they've been exposed to it and that's their environment. So it'd be the same for us, which has led on to a whole bunch more research and projects coming up in the future as well.
And has the diet that you ate when you're in Greenland and when you go back to it, has that changed how you eat in other places?
100%. Yeah, absolutely. As a chef for 30 years, I was always into the Michelin star type thing where you've got multiple courses and it's quite elaborate. I worked in a 2 Michelin star place, which is fantastic. But you've got 5 chefs with tweezers around a plate. And Greenland has totally changed that. It's taken me back to a much simpler type of food, sharing communal platters, very simply done. You don't need 30 different sauces or types of salad or anything like that to have a really good meal. But if most of your listeners were to name the best kind of experience, it wouldn't be a 20-course, $500 Michelin star thing. It would be a big platter of ribs or chicken wings and a pitcher of beer or something very basic like that. And it's great when it's not just the actual function of eating, it's the community. And again, that is something that is hardwired into us because that's how we've always lived. We've always had that community. We've always had to work together to bring down big game or to hunt or to prepare food. That's another thing that's got lost in the capitalist society. Everything becomes about money and we've lost all those things that were key elements of our whole dining experience, which was the community and the education and chat and finding out what everyone did over the day and where the good game is living at the moment or if they think there's a storm coming or how do you build a house like that's a brilliant house. Things like that were always done over food and sharing food and always really simple food because, again, energy conservation would have been for the vast majority of our time here is absolutely essential. So you wouldn't have time to stick a pot on the boil for 24 hours to slow cook anything. If you would have cooked it at all, it would have been really quickly. You would have been gnawing and using your jaws, expanding it. That's the whole Western price thing. It's using your actual jaws instead of all this pappy stuff we have now with processed food, which hardly involves your mouth at all. You can just mush it up. So yeah, that's a big part.
Yes. So we talked a lot about your past journeys from Greenland and the other places where you've lived working as a chef. So now let's move on to projects that you're looking at doing. I know you have a big project plan in 2026. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so part of the whole anthropology thing is, say you take the human lifespan or evolutionary period as 2 million years, it goes back way further. If you take the last 2 million years, it was only up until 10,000 years ago that we changed our diet and became much more heavily into grains and dairy. So the carb intake went right up. And then that trickled along probably for the next 9,500 years until we hit the period we're in now, which I call the industrial period of food. So yeah, stuff started getting processed a lot more, and it's only recently that it's gone crazy. So that gives us effectively 3 main human diets. So we've got the hunter-gatherer, we've got agriculture, and then we've got industrial. So I thought, wouldn't it be cool if I could do a year's project, 3 months each one. So I do 3 months on the hunter-gatherer. And then during that time, I speak to experts and foragers and hunters here in England to see what we would have eaten 50,000 years ago when we first came into Europe. And is it possible to actually replicate that diet? Because we've genetically modified pretty much everything, the apples and the fruit and everything we would have selected, and that would have grown and changed into one that's got bigger apples, etc. Yeah, there's still quite a few things around in the hedgerows and stuff and the venison and stuff, but wild boar and all that has gone by the by. So wouldn't it be cool if I could go onto that diet, eat it as much as I could with full med tests, blood tests, stool tests. But also during that time, I'm going to go back to Greenland. What I'm trying to do is cross the ice cap, eating only a seal, which is a little side project of it. So 30 days to cross. If I take one seal and then map how the makeup, the physiology and the bacterial content of that seal change over those 30 days, because as it rots, it will attract new bacteria, release new nutrients, and also measure that on my microbiome. So that would be a really interesting one. And also spending 4 weeks in Namibia with the Bushmen in the Kalahari. Totally different style, but effectively the same. Just a lot of raw, fermented, cooked meat, but very simple. And then the next 3 months will be the agricultural diet. So here on my homestead here in Suffolk in the east of England, I've got 1.5 acres. So I'm going to get Iron Age pigs and ancient breed sheep. I'm growing Emma and einkorn wheat and naked barley and vetch, which is most closely resembles the ancestors of what we eat nowadays. Honey, what else was there? There's a whole bunch. And not only document how it affects my body, but how bloody difficult it is to do agriculture and farm in the first place. It's absolutely nuts. I've grown wheat here before to try and make my own bread. And it's so much work involved.
Oh, yeah.
To get a crappy loaf of bread. So that whole story of how and why we got into agriculture is super fascinating to me. It's really incredible. So that would be really interesting. And during that time, I'll be spending time in the Carpathian Mountains in Transylvania, or just outside Transylvania, working with shepherds, going with remote shepherds, ancient breed sheep, making cheese, milk, and living with them. And also to Georgia, as in the country, and Azerbaijan, where they had the part of the Fertile Crescent, where they first had the first semblance of farming. Then the third one, I'll go on to industrial diet. So 60% of my diet, my calories will be from processed food, which I'm really not looking forward to at all.
I wouldn't imagine.
I'm really not looking forward to that, because it's not an out and out pure science experiment. If after halfway through I've put on 2 stone and I'm all spotty, and I'm going to say, right, it's clear the way this is going, let's stop it. And your more astute viewers might have noticed that 3 times 3 months isn't quite a year. So for the final 3 months, and during this whole time, I've got a whole bunch of experts, from nutritionists to government advisors, food advisors, doctors, paleobotanists, archaeologists, all looking at the diet and trying to advise me on how to eat as close to those diets as I can. And they'll be looking at the results of those 3 diets. And between us, we're going to try and pick an optimum diet for today's society, for today's world. So taking into account we have 7 billion people, we've got a changing climate, animal welfare. Most of the animals that we produce live and die in horrible conditions, full of chemicals. Yeah, nothing like how they should be. So we're going to try and cherry pick the best bits of each diet, if there is one in the industrial, who knows, and then try and work it around and try and come up with a diet that fits for nowadays lifestyle and operating within a capitalist society. Whether that's possible or not, I don't know. But what I'm really hoping is to further the discussion of our food system, how we are designed to eat and live. And if I can bring it to at least one person's attention that actually we shouldn't be satisfied or happy with what we've got at the moment, because it's wrong and it's killing us. So if I can get one person to look back and change their lifestyle, have a better life in the future, then I'll be happy.
That's a very exciting study that you have planned for it. And I know that obviously the industrial is the part that you're least looking forward to all of it, but I think that there is a lot to be learned about it. One question I have, when you do the industrial diet, will you be buying the most conventional processed foods, or would you get, say, organic cookies?
I will take what the average British person eats. So yeah, it's not all going to be KFC and McDonald's. There's going to be an element of that, but there'll be ready meals. And as you know, ready meals come from the cheapest garbage you can eat.
Yes.
Up to quite a high quality that hasn't been processed that much. So I will take an average of the whole lot. So I'm not going to eat all out the worst to make the figures look bad. I'm going to eat an average one. Again, it's not just me coming up with it. It's this whole panel of experts as well. So it's going to be a group effort on it, which I think will make it as accurate as possible. But it'll be really interesting to see how my blood tests and microbiome change over those 3 diets.
Absolutely, yes. And as you do these different ones, is there also a lot of travel involved with each of the diets?
Yeah, part of the industrial diet will be coming to the States. But
oh, well, that's fair. There is the term standard American diet for a reason.
Yeah, but obviously, I think England's second behind the States in terms of the food system as well. So there's not a lot in it. But I think people will be fascinated to see the processes that the popular foods go through, like vegetable oil. Sounds great, vegetable oil, but it's not vegetables. How many times you squash a broccoli or an eggplant and get oil out of it? It's like never. So how the hell do you get oil? And you know, probably as well as I do, the process that it goes through is absolutely horrendous.
Oh, yes.
And
see the process. There's a thing you can see on YouTube, and I put it on my blog as well, of how canola oil is made.
Yeah, it's revolting. It looks like Vaseline. It's absolutely disgusting. It has to be deodorized and bleached to make it the product it is. And how it came about, obviously, was, again, connected to the capitalist system of trying to make an extra buck out of essentially a waste product of the petrochemical industry. But there's loads of examples like that. And a lot of popular, look at crab sticks. That's a disgusting thing as well. Crab sticks taste great. I used to love them. Dipped in mayonnaise. Another thing that's absolutely disgusting, mayonnaise. But there is a way you can make food fantastic without having to go through all this process. Your mayonnaise is great. And if you make it from scratch, I made mayonnaise in Greenland from seagull eggs and rendered seal fat. And it's fantastic. There's no reason why you can't make it from rendered animal fat. That's what hollandaise is, effectively butter mixed with egg yolks. It's the same process as mayonnaise. It's fat being emulsified in the egg yolks. So yeah, rendered seal fat mayonnaise is unbelievably good. It's fantastic. Yeah, and good for you.
You're right. The vegetable oil does make it sound much better than it is. It's also a very broad term because there's all kinds of vegetables used for oils. And that's why I'm glad now that people are hearing the term seed oils, because that's really what it is. And the bad oils, they're made from the seed, because people say, well, it's olive oil, avocado oil. Those are seed oils, right? And no, because yes, they have seeds, but you don't take the seeds to make them. And that's where the difference lies.
They're the good ones. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Another part I think is fascinating about your program for next year is you talked about the wheat, because there is a lot of debate of, is wheat a traditional food? And obviously, as you point out, it's part of the agriculture part, not the hunter-gatherer. And there's a lot of ways to properly prepare wheat, as the Weston Price talks about. When you're doing this, will this be sourdough bread that you're making?
Yeah, totally. Fermented breads and all that. I had a great podcast chat with an archaeologist from Denmark, I think it was. And they're looking at evidence in Jordan of bread baking that goes way back further than we ever thought before.
Right.
Yeah, I've heard something about that. 18,000 years or 15,000 years or something crazy like that. It's incredible. And the techniques that they have in archaeology now are just unearthing and bringing to life things that we never could tell before. So it's a really constant moving subject as well. There's things being unearthed all the time. But yeah, ferments and that experiment into where that line is between fermented and rotten, because yeah, they're both the decomposition of food. But according to the official definition, one is safe and the other's not.
Yeah, that's true. And fermentation going wrong can be rotten. I've had some experience of sometimes doing that. That doesn't mean that I'm going to stop on fermented foods, but I've done some things wrong.
Yeah, most of the time when people get ill through these old methods is when us Westerners step in and say, oh, that's unsanitary, you've got to do it this way.
Yes.
And
that's a big part of what leads to the problem of Western solutions. Just, absolutely, 100%.
They've been doing it fine for thousands of years. Just leave it alone. But for some reason, we have to put all these steps in and regulation and get it signed off. And it doesn't work if you do it the Western way. And most of the time, instead of natural fiber wrappings, they'll put rubber or put it in glass or oxygen-free environment so that it becomes anaerobic, which is not what it does in the wild or in the indigenous diets. And then all of a sudden you've got botulism or something happening. And well, who would have thought that? It's like, just leave it alone. Do it how we used to do it. It's fine.
Yes. The biggest problem related with that, I think, is pasteurization, because we've been drinking raw milk for a long time.
Exactly.
And then with industrialization and capitalism, as you talk about, that's what changed and made raw milk unhealthy.
Yeah.
So we have this problem with pasteurization, which it's in other foods too, because going with bread, yeah, bread making goes back longer than we think. But what is recent is the baker's yeast. That is what led to bread, among other things too. I'm not going to say it's just that, like all complicated things. It's a number of items, but the baker's yeast. Because I see sourdough bread as essentially the grass-fed beef of bread.
Yeah, absolutely. Sourdough and a 24-hour ferment or something on a bread is incredible. And there's heaps of research and results in that, yeah, it's better for you and it's more attuned to it. You can digest it. It metabolizes a lot easier. You're dead right on the pasteurization. You know, we've been drinking unpasteurized for 99.9% of the time we've been dairying, which is like 10,000 years, or whatever. And then when money started getting involved, it went into the cities. A lot of the workers were ill when they were milking it, and people cut corners and put loads of extra stuff in it that wasn't right. And then suddenly the money guys get hold of it and patent pasteurization and all the machinery and stuff that goes with it. And it turns into a massive corporation like it does now, with barely any of the health benefits of unpasteurized milk. For some, it's nuts. Although people are whipped up by the authorities, regulations, and all the scaremongering. and it just doesn't stand on its feet. It doesn't make sense.
And pasteurization has gotten into some things that people probably don't even realize. Obviously, listeners of this show will know more about it, but the best example I can think of is when you see in a supermarket raw almonds, they're actually not raw. All they're required to do to be called raw is you have to heat it at 1 degree below pasteurization. And so I will not buy raw almonds, as they call it, in a supermarket. I buy them from farmers.
Yeah, and unfortunately, if you go to the supermarket, you look around and it says low protein, low fat, super healthy, good for you. Pretty much every single product you see in the supermarket is not there to make you healthy or to be good for you. It's to make money. Whether it's a product that's supplied or produced by a small maker to the massive Nestle's and Kellogg's kind of guys. But that's only because of the system we've created, this need to constantly cut costs and increase sales. And where can we cut costs next? Of course, a natural progression of that is going to be increasing the shelf life or making it so that it can be stored at ambient temperature as opposed to being refrigerated, because then we can make loads more of it and we don't have to refrigerate it. It's just a really slippery slope that we're on, and trying to pull us back from that is a big task.
Yes, definitely. And so we've covered the different stages. We talked about the industrial one, which obviously not the most anticipated, but important to do. And then the agriculture one, which is very Western price. And then there's also the hunter-gatherer. So for this, will you be hunting food yourself?
Yeah, I'll be going out in England. I'll be in the Kalahari with the Bushmen, and I'll be doing something in Greenland. Hopefully it'll be the ice cap one, but it's a bit of a nightmare trying to get permission to actually cross. So I'm working on that. But if not, I'll just stay in one place and eat seal for a month and see what happens. So yeah, I'll be out there hunting and just seeing how we used to do it, because these indigenous groups have still got the skills that we've had for millions of years. Everyone was indigenous at one point and everyone had those skills to operate in their landscape. But us, the civilized world, has lost it. We've forgotten all those traditions. We've forgotten all those skills, and there's nothing to pass down. It's not much of a skill where you have to go to the supermarket and pick out a few bits of veg and a pizza. The way we used to do it, and procuring the meat or whatever it is by yourself without refrigeration and all the conveniences of modernity, is an amazing thing. And it's that sense of community. And again, that's something clearly in the last year, especially, we've totally lost that sense of community. Everyone seems to be at each other's throats. And I think it's just a natural progression of us moving away from having food as a central part of our lives.
And have you hunted before?
Yeah, I've assisted hunters in Greenland. I've done quite a bit of fishing. I shoot pigeons and game birds here. I haven't shot any big ones because we've got much tighter gun laws than you guys, but I'm working on it. So yeah, I go out with a stalker and we shoot venison. We shot venison about 8 months and 9 months ago.
So that sounds like an exciting part of the program for next year. As I'm sure also the farming and gardening, that would probably be exciting.
It's like I've just come off, and I'm not here to say everyone's got to be on a carnivore diet, because again, that's one of the big, not misconceptions, but big things out there. If you look in social media land, there's so many differing opinions and it's so confusing. If people haven't done the research, or they haven't had time, or they just don't know about it, you look out there and you get bombarded with vegans are great, carnivores great, everyone's just fighting against each other. And then you scratch below the surface and most of them are sponsored by someone who's got a vested interest. So it's quite difficult and time consuming to do your research and actually find out the true story, which is part of the reason I'm doing it. I'm testing it on myself. I'm putting all the information out there for free. I'm not sponsored by Coke, or I'm not sponsored by any big company or any companies at all at the moment, but no one that's got a vested interest or can cherry pick the results. I just want it to be available out there. Like, all my medical tests are available on my website for free. If you want to look at them, just go ahead. It's interesting. I'm not here to say everyone's got to be on a carnivore diet, because a vegan diet can work. Supplements, which I'm not great on, but it can work for some of the time. And again, we're super adaptable. I just went on a fast for 5 days, eating less than 600 calories a day. And that was a vegan diet. And yeah, day 4 and 5, I felt fantastic. And my ketones were way up there. So I'm happy to look at any diet. And I think as long as it's a natural diet, I don't think you can go far wrong.
Me too. I used to be very critical of the vegan diet. Part of it was it is different from, as evolutionists told us and the history of culture have told us. But if it works for people, then I'm not against it. Of course, I've known people that it hasn't worked for. So now with the carnivore diet, I had loosely heard of it years ago, but now that's becoming more of a thing, I look at it the same way if it works for people. Of course, for me, this is the appropriate omnivore, so I see the importance of eating both. And especially as you talk about ferments, I think fermentation is one of the best ways to consume plants.
And an interesting thing about another little side project was looking into, I think it was around 2 million years ago, our brains started getting much bigger. And the prevailing theory on why that was is because our diet changed from being a herbivore and in the trees to on the plains and eating meat, eventually bigger game. But a lot of that would have been fermented as we scavenged, because we only started working together in groups a million years ago or so. So any meat that we had would have been after the big carnivores have left and you go back to it, which is what vultures and hyenas and stuff, as soon as they've been scared away, a lot of the meat we ate would have been fermented. And this John Speth from Michigan has got well over 200 instances documented of tribes in the tropics where if they're presented with a fresh kill, like an antelope, instead of eating it there and then, a beautiful fillet steak, they'll bury it or they'll hang it up for a week for the flies and the bacteria to work on it. So it's been pre-digested. It's easy for us to metabolize, which again goes back to that energy conservation instead of us eating it straight away and having to, oh God, I've got 2 kilo of beautiful antelope fillet in my stomach. Come back to it 5 days later and when it's gone really high and it's full of bacteria, all the work's been done for you. So yeah, you can eat it, process it, metabolize it, and boom, you're off again, which I think makes a beautiful sense.
Yeah, absolutely. As you are speaking at the Wise Traditions Conference for the Weston A. Price Foundation, something that comes to mind is the studies of Dr. Weston A. Price. He traveled around the world and noticed different cultures. And so has his studies and the book Nutrition and Physical Degeneration been a major influence on you?
Yeah, it has. It broadened my look because I was quite laser focused on just the food. Like yourself, as soon as you start digging into it, it has ramifications through absolutely everything. Our jaws, modern teeth are rubbish. It's probably a $1 trillion industry is dentistry. But why is that? Because Mother Nature has done such an amazing job of evolution on us. Surely what would have happened 1,000 or 10,000, 50,000 years ago if we had terrible teeth? And the answer is we didn't. We had bloody fantastic teeth. It's only with a modern diet, soft foods, we don't chew it anymore, we're not grinding through gristle and sinews, which sounds like an ideal place now, but it's not, because our jaws have got smaller, it's more crowded, and our teeth looks like gravestones in a cemetery. It's awful. And that's not how we've evolved, which is exactly what Weston Price found. And especially when he went back afterwards, after modern civilization had got hold and their teeth had degenerated and the general health was terrible. But you know, that was my big jump from food into actual physiology. But then it just follows on to shoes. We've only had shoes for a few thousand years. Again, and every runner is in trainers or running shoes is a heel strike first. Whereas there's thousands of documented instances where indigenous tribes are running up to 100 miles a day barefoot. And when you're barefoot, you're a 4-foot strike, which we're much more technologically and mechanically designed to do. So it's that. And you start looking around at absolutely everything we're doing to ourselves now, and you wonder how we're still alive, you know, how as a species. Yeah. So it's so fascinating.
Yes. Your journey is very similar to Dr. Weston Price, because he originally went around the world just to study teeth, but then learned a lot about nutrition and whole physiology of people. So I would say that you are the Dr. Weston A. Price of chefs.
Oh, my word. Thank you very much. That's too great an honor.
You deserve it. You've definitely earned it with what you're doing.
Oh, thank you.
We're just about out of time, but before we go, let the listeners know where they can go online to see your website and your social media.
Oh, sure. Yeah, everything's Eat Your Environment. So on Instagram and TikTok at Eat Your Environment. My website is at eatyourenvironment.com. There you go.
Wonderful. Mike, thank you so much for coming on the program. I can't wait to see your talk in Salt Lake City and then hear about the program that you're going to start in 2026. Got a lot to look forward to.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on, Aaron. It's brilliant to speak to you. I can't wait to catch up with you in Salt Lake City. It'd be brilliant.
Same. All right. This has been great. That's all for this episode of The Appropriate Omnivore. New episodes of this show are released every Wednesday. Follow me on social media for more information on the next episode. And to make sure you never miss any of my podcasts, subscribe to The Appropriate Omnivore on your favorite podcast site or app. You can also listen to all my podcasts on my website, appropriateomnivore.com. There you can find recipes from the guests I interview, plus all of my articles covering lifestyles in the world of real food. Until next time, my pantry is officially closed.